From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. It's a Veterans Day show today, starting with the effort to transform the iconic old soldiers' home into housing for at-risk and homeless veterans.
This is what this building was originally designed for. It was designed for housing for our neediest of veterans after the Civil War and continuing on into the 20th century up until the late 1980s when it was shut down.
Later, a Milwaukee filmmaker shares the story of his uncle, who joined the Navy at age 15 to fight in World War II.
We'll speak with a New York musician on a mission to bridge the gap between civilians and veterans.
I think that it's incumbent upon civilians to go beyond their gratitude and learn as much as they can about what many veterans are struggling with, and also the fact that there are many veterans, and some say even most veterans, that are not struggling.
And Bubbler Talk takes on the rivalry between Illinois and Wisconsin. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Veterans Day is not officially until tomorrow, but today marks the federal and state government observance of the holiday honoring veterans of the armed forces for their service. The holiday was actually created and championed by UW-Madison graduate Harvey Higley, who was a veteran of World War I and administrator of Veterans Affairs under President Eisenhower.
But long before the U.S. government designated a holiday honoring veterans, President Abraham Lincoln signed a bill to create soldiers' homes around the country for people who fought in the Civil War. One was built in Milwaukee in 1867, and it's one of three original soldiers' homes still standing.
But the original building has been out of regular use for nearly three decades, and the years of neglect have taken their toll. There's peeling paint everywhere, mold damage, and crumbling floors and ceilings. The facility was listed on the National Trust for Historic Preservation's 11 Most Endangered Sites list 6 years ago, and since then, efforts have been underway to preserve it.
And that's finally what is going to happen. A $40 million public-private partnership will see six buildings, including the iconic original Old Main Building, rehabilitated and developed as housing for more than 100 homeless or at-risk veterans.
Work is scheduled to get underway early next year, but I had a chance to step inside the 150-year-old building recently and talk with several of the people involved in the effort. Jonathan Beck is the development project manager for the Alexander Company, the developer that is conducting the restoration work.
Carl Miller is the CEO of Miller Communications and the co-chair of the Save the Soldiers Home campaign. We also heard from Jim Duff, director of the Milwaukee County Veterans Service Office, and from Jonathan Beck, development project manager for the Alexander Company.
This project is no small task. The building has been closed since 1989. It has fallen into disrepair, but not unlike, you know, many structures, you know, around our country, we are going to be doing an adaptive reuse.
Define for people who aren't familiar with it, what you mean by the term adaptive reuse.
Adaptive reuse means we are going to be, you know, bringing back the exterior and the main corridor, you know, historic features, and preserving those while adaptive really using the building and bringing it up to today's standards. So new mechanical, electrical, plumbing, new units, fixtures, and making it habitable again. It's not preserving, per se, you know, like a museum quality. It's an adaptive reuse of retrofitting the building while keeping all the prominent historic features that the Department of Interior wants to see in a National Historic Landmark building.
Right, I was going to ask how you decide what the features of the original. I mean, we're looking around us, and there are these pillars that are kind of crumbling, but
right,
some of the work on them looks like, you know, something that you would never see in 2017.
Right, you know, on deciding what is kept and what goes, it's a real negotiation between our architects on this project. It's Elan Wilson and then the owner, Alexander Company, and the Housing Authority, working with the State Historic Preservation Office and the National Park Service to define really, you know, how do we best meet the Department of Interior standards when looking at each of these historic features? So, you know, the slate roof, that's staying. These columns are staying. In the interior corridor, the entryways and the grand arches, those are staying. There's 568 windows, all unique within themselves. Those are all staying. But again, you know, all new electrical systems, mechanical framing, that will all be new.
How much did you know about what you'd face for the renovation before you walked in this? I mean, this building had been off limits for a long time. How many question marks were there before you could get in and really figure out what it was going to take?
Well, I think that there's always question marks going into any, you know, historic building like this. But our company was founded in the early 80s, 1982. We've done over 150 adaptive reuses of historic structures all around the country. Each one is very different, but you know, we know how to go about tackling a project like this. We actually just started construction on another Milwaukee project called the Fortress Building, which is in the Brewers Hill neighborhood. It's about a $55 million redevelopment, similar size and scope of complexity, but a lot of the same challenges. But that's why the Department of Veterans Affairs, when they selected a development team, they wanted a group that had that expertise in tackling tough projects like this. So,
explain where we are and what this space stands to be, or spaces like it stand to be.
Right. This right now we're right near the original entrance of the main building. It's the grand entrance. Unfortunately, it's not a handicapped accessible entrance, but it will remain an exit. But this would be right where we're standing. As you can tell, that we're in what's going to be a unit with 10-foot high ceilings, enormous windows, great light. This would be a one-bedroom unit. In the main building, we're going to have 80 units, 72 one-bedrooms, 8 two-bedroom units, and approximately 20,000 square feet of supportive service space for the veterans living here. In the remaining buildings, we will have 21 units. Some of those are family units, three bedrooms. Others are single-room occupancy units. But again, it'll be a collective of 101 units. Main building, 80 units. That's the first phase that we anticipate to start construction.
When you dig into one of these projects where you're taking a historic space like this and, as you describe it, you know, doing an adaptive reuse of it, and you stand in a place like this, is your mind full of what this is going to look like someday?
Oh, I mean, that's one of the most rewarding aspects of the job that I, and the career that I've developed over the past 20 years, is always the before and the after. So to have that vision of what this space looks like after we're done with the renovations, definitely.
What's the time frame?
We hope to start construction first quarter of next year. It'll be a 16-month construction time frame, and we hope to be placed in service with residents living here in late 2019.
I'm looking forward to standing in this same space in like 18 months.
Right, and you know, just like, so we're celebrating the 150th of the start of the construction, but it took 2 years in 1867 to develop the building, and it'll take us 2 years really to get this, the doors open again.
Jim Duff and his organization are also a key part of the equation. Duff is the director of the Milwaukee County Veterans Service Office and describes himself as a cheerleader on the project. He says it was important to be able to provide services to at-risk veterans and also important to be able to do that in these buildings.
Well, I think, first of all, this is what this building was originally designed for. It was designed for housing for our neediest of veterans after the Civil War and continuing on into the 20th century up until the late 1980s when it was shut down. We have a large population of very low-income veterans in our area, many of them in danger of homelessness on virtually every month. The 101 units that are going to be created here by Alexander Company are going to go a long way to providing stable, affordable housing for those veterans, and in some cases for small families. So it's a necessary and a needful project for this area.
The project involves stakeholders at several levels, from Milwaukee County to the Department of Veterans Affairs, from the Alexander Company to the National Trust for Historic Preservation. But the community at large is playing a role as well. While $36 million in funding is secured, an additional $4.25 million is the target for the Save the Soldiers Home campaign. H. Carl Miller, CEO of Miller Communications, is co-chair of the campaign. The recent trip to Old Main was his first time inside the building, and he explained why this effort spoke to him.
Well, you know, I'm from the Vietnam War era, and in addition to everything else, a couple of my best friends went into the Army, were drafted into the war, and one at least came out severely psychologically affected by it. Wound up becoming a homeless vet, finally rescued from the streets of New York, brought back home, never recovered, and committed suicide. So I think a lot about the young men that went to war, served their country, came back, and really couldn't find a place back here, never had a future. Bright, young, strong young men. And I think about the services that can be provided at a place like this where they feel not just welcome, this is a home for them, for all the reasons you've heard from other veterans. I think very important to serve that purpose, but doing it and preserving this legacy is pretty incredible. Yeah.
It is really amazing to be standing in this space and imagine what it was 150 years ago.
Exactly. And how the returning vets from the Civil War had nowhere to go, no hospitals, no homes, nothing, and how the women of Milwaukee decided to do something about it and built an incredible legacy that we almost lost. I mean, it was in real danger just collapsing. So being able to accomplish all this in one program is pretty unique and pretty special for everybody.
Is there... I guess there's no really good way to put this. Does it sadden you in some way that we have to raise money in this way, that we as a country just haven't committed the resources to doing what needs to be done for veterans who are at the greatest risk?
Well, you could put it that way. I think it's an exciting opportunity for a relatively small amount of money to leverage all this investment. And I really believe we can and will do it. And then once we're done with this, people get excited. Okay, what comes next? What else can we do? So I think what we've received so far is a lot of enthusiastic support. And I don't think we need to go to the taxpayers every time we try to do something.
As someone who has been part of this community for as long as you have, it's something to have thought of this building sitting here vacant, being such a signature part of the Milwaukee skyline, being vacant for so long.
Right. But I think a lot of Milwaukeeans have driven past this on the freeway, et cetera, wondered what was here. And then the people who do come here are just awestruck. So how do we bring more and more people here and make this a destination for first people in Wisconsin? But then I think people from all over the world would want to see this. It's an important part of our history.
At WUWM.com, you'll be able to see photos of what the inside of Old Main looks like today, and we'll revisit the space as work gets underway.
We'll take a quick break now and then meet a Milwaukee filmmaker who shares the story of his uncle, who enlisted at age 15 in the U.S. Navy to fight in World War II. You're listening to Lake Effect from WUWM. Continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Ever been to Antarctica? Maybe not, but if you find yourself there, make a note of a peak known as Mount Liptak. That mountain is named after Lester Liptak, the uncle of a Milwaukee filmmaker.
Ryan Alsop is the writer and director of a short film about his uncle's unique story in which he enlisted, underage, in the Navy during World War II. He was one of an estimated 200,000 underage soldiers in the war. Not that enlisting was easy or straightforward.
Don't get me wrong. The Navy needs plenty of able-bodied men. But we do need men.
Have a look. I'm 18.
You know, it's hard to believe a word you're telling me, son, when you don't look a day over 10 and a half.
The film is called Mount Liptak, and it is a snapshot of the circumstances that led Lester to enlist at age 15. Alsop spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski and explained how he came to learn his uncle's story.
Lester Liptak is a hero in my eyes. He also happens to be my uncle. But over the years, I've heard these stories of his life and his service in the Navy and all the things that he had done. And then it kind of all came to fruition this last Christmas when I heard the final story of how he had had a mountain named after him on Antarctica. And I just, being a filmmaker and one who tells a lot of stories and loves writing and stories, it just clicked. It was just the final thing. Like, this is a movie right here. This is incredible. Mm-hmm. So it kind of clicked. And I just knew I had to shoot it, and I knew I had to write it. So spent the next 4, 5, 6 months kind of researching this whole topic of enlisting underage and how big of a story it actually is and how many people have never even heard of it before.
Right. Well, many of us have not heard of it. Do you imagine that so many people got to enlist underage just because of the scale of the war, that maybe the people in the services were more inclined to let certain things slide through?
Yeah. So while doing the research, and I've interviewed Lester countless times. He now currently lives in Florida. So while interviewing him countless times, I've asked him about others, and then I've gone through newspapers, books. Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of material out there. So I've gone through a lot of it and done a lot of research, and it all seemed that people almost looked the other way because times were so tough that there weren't many other options, and kids had to provide for their family and had to help in any way possible. I've read stories of teachers helping kids lie about their age to enlist. I've heard pastors helping their families, lie about their age. What Lester told me was that it was a very popular under-the-table type of thing that happened back then.
Okay. Yeah, and what Lester did was forge his baptismal certificate. But what were the circumstances that he was facing in which he felt that he had to enlist?
It's portrayed in the movie 100% accurately, but it doesn't seem real. It's crazy. I'll start from the beginning. His father was on strike at the local factory, and their family was struggling to get by. His dad was the only one providing any income, and they had a large family. And one day, they decided they couldn't do it anymore, so the dad had to go back to work, had to cross the picket line. And back then, that was a really big deal to cross the picket line. You just don't do it. From the countless interviews that I've done, Lester said, back then the unions and the factory were kind of owned by thugs and criminals and mobsters, and they wanted to set an example out of his dad. So that night he came home, and his dad had been murdered for crossing the picket line. And he instantly became the oldest man in the family at the age of 15 and had no choice. So he had already dropped out of school, started getting a job, and then realized that the only way to get an actual steady income that was enough to provide for his family was to lie about his age and enlist in the Navy at the age of 15.
Why did he pick the Navy over the other branches of service?
The true story is that he actually had been working part-time at an airport, and he was just doing odd jobs around the airport. And that's where he first got his first interest into planes and flying. That's where I think he really got his passion to want to go into the Navy to be a pilot. And he ended up not actually being a pilot, but a crew chief, which is kind of in charge of all the plane mechanics and everything. So, yeah, working young at an airport in Cadillac, Michigan, kind of just doing some odd jobs around the airport.
So you mentioned you learned of the story of a mountain being named after him, which we'll get to later, around Christmas of last year. So was the timeline really this quick? For a short film, it's pretty amazing to get the story, write it out, and to film and shoot it and complete it pretty recently.
Yeah. It was definitely a very fast turnaround. And I wanted, it was just because I think my passion for this story and this film, I wanted to get it out to the world as fast as possible, I guess. So, yeah, I decided last Christmas after I heard the final story that I needed to start writing. So I started writing it, researching it, interviewing Lester and talking to other people, and probably took 4 or 5 months to officially write it, get the script out to about 16, 17 pages. And all while doing that, I was kind of gathering a team of producers and cinematographer and people along the way to help shoot this. And then we picked the deadline of, not the deadline, the start of, to film it June 21st, where we first started our production at Waukesha County Airport, where we had kind of rented out the corner of the airport and had a bunch of World War II planes fly in and start shooting that day. So yeah, it was from Christmas to June 21st, so just under 6 months from the idea to writing to actually shooting it.
That's amazing. And I have to ask, I was curious about the airport. How did you manage to secure those vintage planes to be able to do this project with such authenticity?
Yeah. So, you know, that was the biggest thing when I was writing. And I was like, if I can't get these planes, it's crucial to the story. So I was like, I'll tackle the biggest challenge first, which I thought was getting World War II planes. And I came across a friend who was a pilot out west, and he reached out to some of his connections and found a pilot in Illinois who owned a vintage 1940s World War II plane and a Navy plane at that fact. I was going to take any plane, really, but it was a 1940s World War II plane. And he lives in Illinois, and the pilot was more than generous to fly up from Illinois for the day, land at Waukesha County Airport for the day, let us film and move his plane around, shoot all around it, and then fly out at the end of the day. It was pretty incredible. But locally, we had actually the Commemorative Air Force Wing of Wisconsin, which has a lot of vintage airplanes. They were very generous and able to give us 4 planes. And so they pulled them all out to the tarmac, and we kind of arranged the 5 total planes. And then it just so happened that one of the businesses on the Waukesha County Airport had a World War II Jeep with a turret. So it was a lot of just luck and just, you know, the universe telling us, yeah. here's a bunch of fun things to help, you know, really sell the aspect of the film being in the 1940s.
Now, you're a Milwaukee native and filmed a lot of this here in the greater Milwaukee area. So I kind of want to go into some of those key sets and details. You mentioned the Waukesha County Airport. But I'm also curious what cemetery you're at, and then what house was the Liptak house? Because there aren't many houses that, you know, some are remodeled and reconstructed, but this one has the classic, like, Cream City brick facade in front and the inside, of course, as well.
I'm so glad that you noticed that. Yeah, it was a lot of searching all around Milwaukee, because that was the biggest thing about shooting this, is having the sets look real, having the locations look real, having everything be authentic. So we were lucky to find actually a Milwaukee County Historical Society in Greenfield called Trimborn Farms. It's this secluded, right in the middle of a bunch of residential homes. They got about 3 or 4 properties that are from the 1800s, 1850s to 1900s. And we were lucky enough to be able to film in that for the house and a lot of the other scenes as well. And then for the cemetery, we were actually filming that south of Miller Park by Lincoln. There's this cemetery right next to a factory called the Old Metal Shop, which is actually where we filmed a lot of different type of scenes. But it was a lot between Trimborn Farms and the Old Metal Factory. Has a ton of great locations in there. The entire officer scene was shot there, along with the picket line scene was shot there, and the cemetery right across the street.
Now, this short film kind of encompasses what he's gone through to get to the point of meeting with an officer to enlist. And with you writing it and obviously knowing the story personally through your uncle, was there anything that he told you that stood out that you had to include, or were there any things that perhaps didn't quite fit into the story but is still a great aspect of his character and what he did?
Yeah, there were many things that he told me that were just too crazy to believe. One of them specifically was that his baptismal certificate was written in pencil. Like, to me, it just, and a lot of people who have like seen parts of the film said the same thing. He's like, well, that just seems too easy. But it's real. He said back then they didn't write him in pen, and that they didn't give birth in hospitals. So that a lot of the births were at home. So the only way of proving their age was when they got baptized at their local church. So the baptismal certificate being written in pencil was something really key that I wanted to keep 100% true. I had read a bunch of different stories, so I had taken a few aspects from other true stories of people who have enlisted, and one of them I thought was very unique was one of the kids said that he went to the local convenience store or general store, bought a bushel of bananas and a liter of milk, and chugged it because he had to make weight. And he went across the street, and then he made weight with help of the copious amounts of bananas and milk. So I added that as part of Lester's story for him to make weight.
Now, Lester Liptak had a very successful career in the Navy. He served, 24 years, had over 12,000 flight hours, obviously kept and sustained his career starting so young at 15. You know, you can't imagine that. But he also led an operation, Deep Freeze, that we referred to a bit earlier. So can you explain that, and how did that result in a mountain being named after your uncle?
Yeah, definitely. So this was the story that I heard about. I've heard about his discovery missions to Antarctica before, but it was the fact of the mountain I heard that he has named after him, which really helped me start this story. And during the 1950s, the U.S. Navy led an operation called Operation Deep Freeze, which went to Antarctica to help map and discover parts of Antarctica that had never been discovered before. And he was the crew chief on those planes. And one of his good friends, Gus Shin, is the first pilot to have ever landed an airplane on the South Pole, technically. So he was a crew chief, and, you know, it's these first times ever that anyone's ever landed a plane on ice, and it's his job to figure out the logistics of the plane and how to land and get off and just keep everything in a working manner. And on those missions, their plane actually crash-landed while discovering the highest range in Antarctica, and they crash-landed while discovering this range. Luckily, they survived and were able to get off Antarctica. One of those mountains, after the fact, have since been named after him, called Mount Liptak.
Now, he is the crew chief of a lot of aircraft. Did he ever express any regret of not being an official pilot when that was his main dream so young?
I don't think so. I think I would have to talk to him again. But I remember him saying and talking about how he had a dream of flying, but once I think he got into it, his dream kind of pivoted to the upkeep and maintenance of the plane and operation of the plane and the engines and everything. So I'd have to talk to him again. But I was pretty confident that he was very happy with being the crew chief. And he was a crew chief on multiple different engine planes and very, very happy with that.
Now, the main question with your uncle is, was he happy with this film?
Yeah, so that was the biggest thing. If there was one critic out there, I wanted him to be happy and proud of it. And I didn't want to have the film portray him in a light that wasn't accurate. So I showed it to him. And he said he cried throughout the film and was very honored that this film was made after him. And I feel incredibly honored to have him as an uncle and that I'm able to tell his story.
As you mentioned, his story is one of many of people who enlisted underage. So do you have plans for the film now that it's complete regarding, just a matter of people seeing it and others sharing their stories of family members or anyone they might know who had a similar situation?
Yeah, of course. And that was the idea behind the film, of how Lester's story is one of thousands. You know, this is just a single thread of a tapestry of so many stories of people that have enlisted underage. And I wanted to use his story to tell a much broader story. And I've read all these stories, and I would love to create a feature-length film. So the idea is that this is a short film that could be a feature-length film of Lester's story or of a much larger story encompassing multiple, you know, unique stories of kids who did enlist underage. The history, people have enlisted as young as 12, and it's just, it's so mind-boggling to think or to try to envision what these kids were, you know, a 12-year-old, going to war. Just, you can't, it's hard to wrap your mind around it. So, you know, telling these stories, I think, is crucial because they haven't been told, and there's so many of them out there that can be told. So the idea right now is to send this out to as many festivals as possible. We've sent it out to a lot already, and we'll be continuing to send it out to more festivals around the state, country, world, and hopefully just tell this story to as many people as possible. And if someone along the line is interested in this story and would like to help make it a feature-length film, we're all excited and looking forward to that opportunity.
Well, you certainly give a great insight and depiction of just a small part of your uncle's story. So, Ryan Alsop, I want to thank you for sharing it with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Milwaukee filmmaker Ryan Alsop is the writer and director of the short film Mount Liptak, about his uncle, Navy veteran Lester Liptak. He spoke with Audrey Nowakowski, and you can find a link to more about the film at WUWM.com.
Another break now, and then a New York-based musician tries to use song to bridge the communication gap between civilians and veterans. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Thank you.
I woke up, looked at the sky. I saw hundreds of planes passing by. I could feel.
More of Lake Effect, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. And that song, Carry You On, is the title track from an album by musician Marcus Goldhaber. It's an album with a unique hook. Goldhaber says its ultimate aim is to get civilians and veterans to have meaningful conversations with each other.
Patient and strong, now it's our turn to carry you on.
Goldhaber has no connection to military life except the experience of meeting veterans at his concerts and elsewhere in everyday life. And so Veterans Day was an ideal time to chat with him about his distinctive approach to bridging the gap. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Mitch. I appreciate it.
What is the conversation you think needs to happen in this country when it comes to veterans and civilians?
I think that it's incumbent upon civilians to go beyond their gratitude and learn as much as they can about what many veterans are struggling with, and also the fact that there are many veterans, and some say even most veterans, that are not struggling. Veterans are not monolithic. That's the big takeaway here. And when they do come home, I think that the stakes have always been high, but they've really never been higher. And I think that when veterans return home, the civilian population that they come home to should be, for lack of a better word, armed with a few tools would allow them to help a veteran out if needed. We should be more involved. We can be more involved. And my goal with this project is to let music sort of bring people to the arena, bring civilians to the arena, bring veterans to the arena, because it's not an easy conversation to have. It's not easy for a civilian to walk up to a veteran that they don't know and say, hey, just want to let you know I'm here. If you need a helping hand, if you don't, that's cool. I'll cheer you on. And I'm grateful. Thank you. That's not easy.
How did you decide you were the guy to do this?
Well, I'm not sure that, I am the guy. I know that I was asked to write a song for a 9/11 compilation CD about 5 years ago. And I, in fact, said no the first couple of times because I told the producer that it wasn't something that I felt I could do, because I didn't think I was, to use your words, the guy. I was writing primarily American songbook style songs and jazz genre. And that was my niche. That's what I was comfortable with. And that's what I knew. And I also had stigmatized what style of music it had to be before I even sat down to explore that process. You know, I thought it had to be something in the George M. Cohen style, or, John Philip Sousa or Lee Greenwood, Bruce Springsteen, or just a country music song that said, I love this country.
Something anthemic.
Something anthemic that, was stuck in a certain genre. And so finally, after a couple of times asking, I finally said, I'm gonna explore this. And I did. And I closed my eyes. I listened to what was missing. What could I, just as an authentic approach, what could I offer out there as a new song, a new message that I could relate to and write honestly? I didn't want to write at a style. And it was this disconnect between civilians and veterans.
Welcome home, my warrior. Is the fighting really done? You've been gone forever, it seems, and there are many who think we won. But how do you feel? And can it be real?
And I thought that's something that I could write about. That's something I could offer. And it grew from there. Started after that song was written. It was called Come Home America. And it was a song about coming, returning to the ideals that we are all in this together.
And all I can say is God bless today.
Talk about how your conversations with veterans informed what this album became.
I would finish performing this again. It's just this one song. And sometimes I would approach certain veterans after the show, just as you would, just after a performance, you know, hey, thanks for coming, or I'm glad I, you know, got to be here. Thanks for having me, that kind of a casual thing. And then the conversation would invariably steer to something that they were dealing with, overcoming, struggling with, or the fact that they weren't struggling at all. And these conversations were informing me in a way that, again, it my only outlet for this new information was to channel it into music, into stories that I could then relay to anyone else that I was meeting in different arenas. So veterans were sharing stories with me about what it was like being away from their kids, what it was like not meeting their kids. I mean, some personal stuff, and that I wasn't asking. It was just came out of a, wow, thanks for doing this, you know, .. that moment in that song really spoke to me. It reminded me of, and then .. they would continue. So I was faced with all of this intimate information. I wanted to communicate it out in song.
You come at this conversation from the civilian side, right? You are not a veteran?
I'm not a veteran.
Was there ever, did you ever encounter veterans who were suspicious of your motives in wanting to have these conversations?
Yeah. It's something I was actually probably more sensitive to than anyone else, especially when I started out. And it's also, remember, what prevented me from even pushing forward and agreeing to write the first song that I wrote.
Right.
Because I felt like, who am I to do this? What gives me the right? I haven't experienced this stuff. And so who am I to take on their voice and put it into song? Sometimes, you know, as a singer as a storyteller, in the first person, you know? And, so that's something I've wrestled with, but, you know, again, no one's ever come up to me and said, who do you think you are? In fact, it's been the other way around.
I wanted to ask about one song in particular, and I was just struck that you have a song specifically about women soldiers, or a woman soldier, and that's not something that we hear a lot about, especially in terms of music.
So Cassandra Knows it's one of the most meaningful songs for me. I mean, first zooming out, I agree with you. I don't think we hear enough about female veterans specifically. Again, it's part of there's both a broad perspective and a nuanced perspective. And we don't hear much of either voice. So this is a song that that tells a story about a woman who realizes that she has to go. She has to go serve. It's what she wants to do. And this song and this story specifically speaks about... tells a story about a woman who had lost some family members as a result of 9/11, and realizing that the way that she can channel and actualize the pain and the loss is by going off to serve herself, because she felt so helpless on that day.
She lays a kiss upon her children, and she swears she'll be home soon. But the kids don't know why she's gotta go and what for. They're gonna have to stick together. They're gonna have to fight each day.
Do you have other gaps that you're hoping to bridge down the road? Can you get Democrats and Republicans to sit and listen to music together?
Well, you know, I'll tell you this. This is a nonpartisan project, and, you know, you hear people say that a lot about a lot of nonprofit work. But, you know, my shows are not only 50-50 civilian veteran, but we experience people from all social walks of life, all political walks of life, and they sit down and we separate and let go of you know, what your political beliefs are, whether you know however you voted in whatever election. That's not what this is about. Music has been such a blessing to soften that road. You know, my message is not subliminal. My message, my lyrics are not, you know, if you play my record backwards, it's not gonna, you know, hypnotize you, or, you know, these are story songs that tell it like it is, as close to like it is as possible. And so this really is a place that people can come together.
Well, listen, Marcus Goldhaber, it's important, good work. And thank you so much for sharing the story of this project with us.
Take care, Mitch. Thank you.
This is the G.I. Jive, man alive. It starts with the bugler blowing reveille over your bed when you arrive. Jack, that's the G.I. Jive.
Marcus Goldhaber is a New York-based musician. His album is called Carry You On, and half the proceeds benefit the organization Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. We reached him via Skype from New York.
One last break, and then we'll shift from Veterans Day to Bubbler Talk, with a story about the cross-border trash talk between Chicagoans and Wisconsinites, just in time for the Bears-Packers game this weekend. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
May with your feet. If you're a PVT, you're...
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Rachel Morello. We recently ran across a Bubbler Talk submission that captured both of our interests.
It came from this guy, Jason Gessner. He's originally from Illinois.
I grew up in Rockford and from an early age basically decided that I was going to move to Chicago as soon as I was done with school.
Jason did live in Chicago for a while until he and his wife had a couple of kids and decided their family needed a change. So they picked a place nearby. A place that would allow Jason to commute to his job in the Windy City, a place where they had friends and had visited several times, a place they'd heard nothing but good things about, Milwaukee.
And this is something that actually Rachel and I have both done. Before coming to WUWM, I worked at a radio station in Chicago, and I grew up in a border town in Wisconsin and had family in Chicago.
Yeah, and I went to school in Chicago, but I'm originally from Milwaukee and moved back here a couple of years ago.
Our question asker, Jason, has now lived in Bayview for about 12 years, and he loves it. But there's an attitude he's observed in his neighbors that he still doesn't quite understand.
You know, I started hearing some of the terms for Illinoisans, and I just never really known that there was sort of a bitterness about Illinois. When I was growing up, friends and family, like, really loved Wisconsin. The outdoors are beautiful here. Like, we'd come up to go fishing or see a ball game or whatever. Yeah, it just sort of took me aback a little bit when I learned that there was this sort of, negative stereotype of Illinoisans coming up and, you know, rampaging around Wisconsin.
You may have heard some choice nicknames tossed back and forth across state lines. Wisconsinites are cheeseheads. Illinoisans are fibs or fish tabs, both terms made up of four-letter words we can't say on the radio.
And Rachel, I know you have a very particular experience with Wisconsin-Illinois trash talking, one that some of our listeners could probably relate to.
I do. I'd say there are a few topics that really get people riled up on either end of the I-94 corridor, namely driving and football. I'm a Packers fan, and when it comes to the NFL, there's no greater rivalry than that between the Green Bay Packers and the Chicago Bears. In fact, those two teams face off this Sunday. That matchup will mark game 196 in the series, which started in 1921. And I'll note for the record, Joy, that the Packers lead that series with more wins than their legendary rivals.
Well, one of the most Chicago people I know would love it if those stats shifted in his favor. His name is Justin Kaufman. He's the host of The Download on WGN 720 in Chicago. And like many of his fellow Bears fans, he has quite a few opinions about the Packers.
I will say this. I really, really hate the Green Bay Packers. I don't know why. I really don't. I mean, they are a great football team, and they don't do anything wrong, but that green and yellow, and I think it's in my head. I think it's from my dad. I think it's from my grandpa. Like, I don't know what it is, but there's something about it that it's the only time that I actually show any emotion while watching a football game. If the Bears are playing the New Orleans Saints tomorrow or the Tampa Bay Buccaneers or even the New York Giants, you're like, if they lose, you're like, meh, move on with my life. The Packers, there's a 20-minute hangover. There's something where I need time. I need space. I need patience. You know, I need to do some meditation, some deep breathing.
Hearing that, what are your thoughts, Rachel?
Well, he's definitely got some interesting opinions, but I'd beg to differ on several of those points and actually reverse them back in his direction, in the direction of his team.
The weird thing about Justin, he's not originally from Chicago. He's from a small town in Illinois called Wonder Lake, which is really close to the Wisconsin border. It's also not that far from where I grew up, in Lake Geneva. But whereas I call myself a Wisconsinite, growing up, Justin very much identified with Chicago.
I always thought of myself as a Chicago suburb, so even being closer to Wisconsin, 15 minutes, as opposed to an hour and 45 minutes from the city of Chicago, I would thump my chest as if, you know, if you mess with Chicago, you're messing with me. And I'm like, as I mean, I could walk to the Wisconsin border. So it's a strange thing to think about, that even though we were, the proximity was off and we were so much closer to Wisconsin, I still to this day consider myself true blue Chicago.
Justin's parents now live in my hometown, and he's heard a lot of the same stereotypes as our question asker, Jason.
They drive too fast. They act entitled when they come up here. They act recklessly in our backyard.
But ultimately, it seems to come down to one thing.
I think every knock on someone from Illinois is the fact that we kind of use and abuse Wisconsin.
What's funny about my family is that both of my parents are actually from Chicago. Not just my parents, but also my grandparents. So although I consider myself a Wisconsinite, my mom, Janelle, has lived here for 30 years but still identifies as a Chicagoan. I called her a few days ago and we dissected some of the complaints we hear about people from Illinois. And it turns out most of these are the same complaints she has about tourists.
The tourists make me crazy. They're on vacation when they come here, so they don't care that they are putting trash and God knows what else on my lawn and under my bushes and all kinds of stuff.
Somebody else with an interesting perspective on the Wisconsin-Illinois divide is Milwaukee Alderman Bob Bauman. Bauman grew up in Edgewater, which is a neighborhood on the north side of Chicago. In fact, he owns the duplex he grew up in, so he's still an Illinois taxpayer. But he's lived in Milwaukee for 40 years and has made a career out of bettering this city. One way he says he does that, by taking cues from bigger cities like Chicago.
It's a matter of sharing ideas and seeing best practices in other cities and learning how they go about solving a problem and then adopting it to our particular circumstances here.
Bauman has used some policies he's noticed in Chicago as models for ideas he's kickstarted as a lawmaker here in Milwaukee. For example, the Common Council implemented a traffic calming ordinance for residential neighborhoods, putting things like speed bumps and traffic circles in place to slow down traffic on side streets. That idea came from Chicago.
Milwaukee has an ordinance to allow honorary street names, another concept it modeled after Chicago policy.
And Bauman says right now he's working on a new affordable housing initiative, and he's looking at Chicago's methods for guidance. Basically, the alderman's argument is that the two cities should view themselves as complements, not competitors.
We share the same weather. We share the same lake. We really share the same basic demographics. We should work together more than we should compete. Trying to encourage my colleagues and trying to encourage the overall sort of Milwaukee culture to think a little bigger than what it has historically done, because we're in a competitive environment in terms of competing for talent and employees and businesses that often follow the employees and follow the talent.
Success in business and industry is a big reason many cite for why the two cities should work to cooperate wherever possible.
Joel Rast teaches at UW-Milwaukee, where he also oversees the university's Urban Studies program. He says the key to cooperation is an expanded view of a concept called regionalism.
It's something that people started talking about as businesses became more and more mobile and globalization became more of a phenomenon. So the concern was that businesses are looking at different places to locate, and if municipalities are all kind of fighting with each other over, you know, trying to get these businesses, then that kind of makes the region as a whole potentially look bad. And it may drive businesses someplace else.
The thinking now is let's all pull together and try to present a united front.
Rast says the two states could have benefited from banding together on the opportunity to pursue Foxconn, the tech company setting up shop in southeastern Wisconsin.
But the way state lawmakers pursued the deal, Wisconsin will pay the incentives, while both Wisconsin and Illinois residents will likely supply employees to the factory due to its location near the border.
Rast says it would help both neighbors to cooperate on future deals as well.
I mean, it would have been nice to have this conversation earlier on with Illinois if, you know, something like that had been possible earlier on to talk about, you know, transportation infrastructure, for example, and, you know, other issues maybe that we could have worked with them on. From what I saw of this deal, it didn't seem like there was much of an effort to coordinate with Illinois at all. At least if there was, I didn't read about it.
But when we're talking about the frustration between Wisconsinites and Illinoisans, it all seems to be a little one-sided.
Especially when it comes to Chicagoans and Milwaukeeans. Here's Justin Kaufman again.
Living in Chicago, there's something about being in a cosmopolitan city, a big city, where we love the concept of a second city, you know, to be the underdog to New York. But anyone who might be an underdog to us, we're like, we don't care.
Although I am told from Milwaukee people that the rivalry between Milwaukee and Chicago exists in the minds of Milwaukeeans. In the mind of Chicagoans, we don't even think about them. We knew Wisconsin existed in Chicago. It is, we were very single-minded. If we thought about another city in Chicago, we'd think in terms of, well, New York, right? That would have been more of a rivalry to us than Milwaukee or Wisconsin.
My mom, the self-professed Chicagoan, appears to be right. This regional rivalry doesn't seem all that mutual. It seems more like an inferiority complex on the part of Milwaukee. And when it comes to Chicago versus New York, well, New Yorkers don't seem to care too much about their smaller rival either.
So this type of animosity is not unique. New Englanders have a famously contemptuous relationship with the people of Boston. Minnesotans poke fun at their rural neighbors in Iowa. And plenty of European nations have their own regional conflicts. But around here, there's one prevailing matchup that we all seem to believe in.
The one rivalry we've been able to pin down is Bears versus Packers.
Oh, absolutely. Bears versus Packers. That's a fact. That's a fact.
That one's
the Bears versus the Packers. That is a rivalry.
Perhaps unsurprisingly, our question asker Jason Gessner is a Bears fan who will make the trek to Chicago's Soldier Field for this Sunday's game.
And even less shocking, his money is on his hometown team.
I think the Bears defense is going to continue to play really well. I think they're going to get a couple of picks against Sunley. And I think the Bears are going to win that game.
Fighting words.
Fighting words, yeah.
Support for this season's Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union, a member-owned credit union dedicated to helping those who live and work in southeastern Wisconsin make informed financial decisions. More at ecu.com. Do you have a question about the Milwaukee area that you'd like us to explore? Well, if so, submit your question at wuwm.com, and maybe you'll be next to quench your thirst for knowledge.
And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. In addition to thanking our veterans, such as my co-host, for their service, we thank our whole production staff today, including Joy Powers, Audrey Nowakowski, and Mayon Silver, along with our intern, Meredith Waters.
We also get reporting from Rachel Morello, Susan Bentz, and Aisha Turner. We also get web support from Michelle Maternowski and engineering support from Jason Reavy. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air comes your way next. It is 11 o'clock.